Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractors Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry will share dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Len Sklar has specialized in collection matters for over 25 years. He has produced audios, videos, training courses, and a book entitled The Check Is Not in the Mail. For 21 years, he managed a collection seminar company, producing over 600 seminars a year in 200 U.S. cities, presented by 14 people that he trained to educate over 30,000 business people per year. He owned a collection agency for 13 years. A few years ago, he began what is now a nationwide credit and collection temporary staffing company, which he has recently sold. As a collection entrepreneur, Len is an expert not only in the techniques of collecting money, but also, more importantly, in the psychology involved, which he believes is at least half the battle.
Getting paid is tough work for large businesses as well as small ones. But for a small or medium-sized business, collecting what's owed you not only affects your income and profit, it can also determine if you stay in business at all. Fortunately, there are a number of immediate, practical things you can do to prevent collection problems from happening in the first place, and then, since you're probably not on an all-cash basis, making sure that you collect as much as possible of what's owed to you, as soon as possible, at the least possible cost, without losing the important customers you want to keep, and with little or no stress. Some of what you need to know is semi-technical, and it's fairly easy to learn and use. The tougher part is the psychological aspect. Here's an example. The single biggest reason why any business has collection problems is the fear of loss. The fear that if you really told your customers, new or established, how you wanted to be paid, some of them would be offended, wouldn't like it, and would threaten to take their business elsewhere. And that's pretty serious. One result of this fear is that most businesses do not have a clear written payment policy, and if they do, they don't communicate it up front, before doing business, or do it with thoroughness or enthusiasm. Every business has a policy for doing business and for getting paid for their product or service. You've heard that nature abhors a vacuum. It's true. If you don't spell out the payment policy, guess who's going to do it for you? That's right, your customers who may already be doing business with you the way they want. The paradox is that if you spell out your payment policy very clearly and mean it, sure, you'll lose some customers, but aren't they the ones you wish would take their business elsewhere? The philosophy that works best is this: you will win more by being willing to lose a few. By having a clear policy on payment, you will actually build your business. Isn't it true that people like to know upfront, prior to doing business, what the rules are? And if you are wishy-washy about this, don't be surprised if your current and prospective customers play with your money. This doesn't mean that you can't cut some people some slack occasionally. It's a lot easier to make an exception from your payment policy if you have a policy to make an exception from. Otherwise, you're just making it up as you go along, arbitrarily. And the word gets around that you can be rolled over easily. So, the starting point in collections is to prevent the problem with a written policy provided to all customers and discussed with them, particularly the parts of your payment policy that in the past customers have given you a hard time about or is different with your business compared to some competitors. In fact, if a customer says X company down the street gives me these terms, why don't you? A good response is this: I'm sure that works well for them, and they have their reasons for it. But here's how we do it. We find this works best for our customers. Then you shut up. I cannot tell you what should be in your policy because it's none of my business to whom you give your products or services away, or give a break to, or under what conditions. What I can tell you is that you must have a policy and discuss it thoroughly with all customers. Some businesses say that this will take too much time. My answer is that if you don't take time to discuss your business and payment policy before you do business, you will spend the time afterward, and it will be a lot more time, and your bargaining position will be weakened because you've already given away your product or service. Now let's move on to dealing with the few accounts that do slip through. A few quick tips. First, if you do work billed at so many dollars an hour, and your customers quibble about how much time you really spent, create a simple form, about 3 inches by 5 inch or 5 by 8, that has space for starting time, ending time, and the customer's initials or signature. You fill in the time started and ended. Let them sign or initial both times and enclose a copy of the form with your bill. That should end most of those disputes. Second tip, if you give estimates for free if you get the job, but you charge a fee if you don't, make that clear in writing and signed by the prospect before doing the estimate. Too many businesses have gotten stiffed on the misunderstanding about this key issue. Incidentally, there are certain issues in every industry and every business that produce predictable collection problems a great deal. And for those situations, I would want the customer to sign for their understanding of the policy and even their agreeing to abide by it, which means to pay for it. For most policy conditions, it's enough that you have the policy in writing and go over it with your customers in advance. For those of you that do billing and send invoices and statements, here are some more useful tips. One, nothing says you have to wait 30 days between statements. It's more cost-effective to bill twice a month, especially for older or troublesome accounts. It'll cost you a little more than billing once a month, but you'll get back money well in excess of what it costs you. Two, with consumer customers, 20% of them move on average every year. So put on each envelope, on the upper left-hand corner, address correction requested, which gets you the envelope back with a new address most of the time, or else print forwarding postage guaranteed, which tells the post office to send the envelope right on to the new address if they have one. Three, after a maximum of two statements, get on the phone. The phone is an incredible 10 times better, that's 1,000% better, than any written statement or Dunning messages in producing results. Later in this tape, I'll give you some tips on telephone collecting techniques. Four, to help ensure that your statement envelope gets opened, add to the front of the envelope the word personal or confidential or personal and confidential. Five, if you have a number of older accounts, you can use an amnesty. Take all accounts over, say, 9 months old and call or write to them stating that if they pay within the next 30 days, you'll deduct 30% and consider the bill paid in full. You'll be amazed at how much money this brings in. The reason is that everybody loves a bargain. Accounts that are 9 months old or older are at best 20% collectible, so the amnesty gets you 70% on accounts that respond, which is a darn sight better than 20%. The philosophy once again is that you will win more by being willing to lose a few. For the accounts that don't respond to the amnesty, write them off, return them into collection. Six, if your customer wants to make payments, ask for postdated checks. Your attorney will tell you that they're perfectly legal in almost every state. Here's how you do it. Your customer and you agree on, say, four payments. Then you say to your customer, the best way to handle this is for you to send in your check for the first payment along with three additional checks postdated for the next three periods. I'm not allowed to deposit them until the dates that are on those checks. In fact, I will call you about 3 days prior to remind you that I'll be depositing the check. This way, you don't have to worry about this bill anymore. The burden is all on me. Now, notice two things about this approach. First, I didn't say I would ask them if it's okay to deposit the check when I call 3 days prior to the date on the check. Instead, I take the positive, assumptive approach, and I say I'm calling to let you know I'm going to put it through, and I wanted to remind you as a courtesy. Now, if your customer tells you not to deposit the check, you cannot, but you will have reduced the probability of that happening. In fact, the odds of a post-dated check being good is well over 95%, and those are good odds. Besides, when you have those checks in your hand, that's a lot better than calling three times and hoping to get the money. Second, notice that even though the post-dated check idea clearly benefits you, you emphasize to your customer how they benefit when you say, this is one less bill you have to worry about. 7. Another tip is a negotiating strategy. Anytime your customer wants to pay any amount less than the full amount, bear in mind that their first offer is almost always the worst offer. It will be the least they hope to get away with, not the most that might inconvenience them and stretch their dollars a bit. So what you do is refuse the first offer. You can say, I wish I could accept that, but our accountant requires that we have all bills paid in not more than three payments, or whatever number you decide. It's always helpful to blame the accountant. This way, you'll get paid in fewer and larger payments. Now, some skeptics will say that your customer might take the position that if you refuse his initial offer, he won't pay you anything. This could happen, but the odds are very slight. And if you do accept the initial ridiculous offer, you're stuck with it. Overall, you're better off pushing for more. The skeptics say that a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, or something is better than I say something may be better than nothing, but it's not as good as something more. Now let me give you some ideas about how to use the phone more successfully in collecting. Many business people are very uncomfortable asking for money, as a result of which they ask badly, or with stammering and hesitation, or not at all. They just use written Dunning messages, which, as I've already said, are nowhere near as effective as phone calls. If you are uncomfortable asking for payment, what you can do is to share the feeling. Say something like this. Asking our customers to pay always makes me a little queasy. I'm not even sure why. Maybe because I'm afraid they'll think I don't trust them to pay or something like that. In any case, you do owe us $500, and we need to discuss how you plan to take care of that in a way that's going to work for both of us. Notice that when you share your feeling, you are talking as one human being to another who could also have a similar discomfort. Then, after you share your feelings, you'll find that you are now much freer to ask for the money. Try it. You'll find that it works. I hope you caught the phrase, take care of it, in a way that works for both of us. That means your customer can't just propose some ridiculous payment plan and that's the end of it. You have to go along with it also. Since far more people ask for money badly than do it right, I'd like to list some of the poor ways of asking for money so that you can avoid them. First one, suppose you say, is there a problem? Never ask if there is a problem. If there is one, they'll tell you about it, either by telling you or by not paying, and you will respond appropriately to that. But don't invite problems. Everyone has them. You do not want to encourage people to tell you about their personal soap operas. You want to discuss payment in spite of the problems we all have. Two, suppose you say this, we'd like you to pay all or at least half. Given that choice, what would you pay? Three, can you send a payment or something on the account? Never, ever say these, because anything you get then is something. If your customer offers something vague like a payment or something on the account, you need to push for a specific commitment. You might respond by saying, that's great, but we need to nail down how much and when. If your customer still doesn't commit, you commit for him, thank him, and hang up. Fourth way of asking badly. Bosses sometimes say to overdue customers, don't worry about it. Don't ever say that because your customer won't worry about it. That is one statement everybody understands and follows to the letter. Five, don't get self-righteous or talk about how you need the money. Your customer doesn't care about your cash flow needs, and they don't want to be lectured about being honest or how you kept your side of the bargain and they need to keep theirs, etc., etc. Six, always ask for the full amount today, no matter how large the bill is. If you ask for anything less, you are bargaining against yourself. You may not get the full amount, but don't give away your negotiating position in advance. It's important to consider that paying bills is highly discretionary. People who aren't paying you are paying someone else, for sure. Someone who says that they don't have any money really means that they do, but they don't think you need it so badly, or other creditors can do them more harm if they aren't paid. Here, then, is the correct way to ask for money. You will be friendly. You'll identify yourself and your company. Identify who you're talking to. Describe the service or product provided, the date or dates, the amount, and then ask for the money. It goes like this. Hi, this is Len Sklar calling from XYZ Company. You're Jim Wilson, the accounts payable manager? Oh, good. I'm calling you about the $575 balance due on the job we did, name the date, and that needs to be paid in full now. Would you rather handle that by, and then tell them the payment method you accept, cash, check, charge card, wire the money, cashier's check, or whatever, and then be silent. This doesn't guarantee payment, but it gets you started right. If they promise to pay, they may pay, or they may just want to get you off the phone. To reduce the odds of what might be an empty promise, you will use a technique known as nailing down the promise. Here's how it works. When you get a promise to pay, say this. That's great. If you write and mail out the check today, it should take no more than 3 days to get here, which is, name whatever that date is. I'll mark it on my calendar for that date, so we're sure not to miss it. In fact, why don't you put my name on the envelope so my office brings it right over to me, and I'll make sure they post it to your account right away. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Now they know you'll be looking for the check. But even though this method reduces the likelihood of an empty promise, it doesn't eliminate it. If the check does not come in, call that day due, not a day or more later, and say something like this. Hi, this is Len Sklar from XYZ Company. Remember that check you said you were going to send me? We didn't get it. Now be quiet and see what they say. They may say, well, the reason you didn't get it is because I didn't send it. I was just kidding you there a couple of days ago. Which means you now know you have a problem, which is bad, but you know it much earlier in the game, which is very good. The sooner you know where you stand, the better off you are. If, on the other hand, they give you some reasonable excuse, even a flimsy one like, we wrote the check but forgot to mail it, let them save face, give them the benefit of the doubt, and ask for a commitment again. If you get it, nail that one down also. But if that check doesn't come in, well, one broken promise, one act of forgetfulness can happen to anyone. But two in a row, within 3 days, I don't think is a coincidence. So you make a third and final call on the date the second promise check is due, and if you get a third promise, you nail it down again. But you add that if the check doesn't come in on that date, you are required by your accountant to turn the account into collection within 2 days, which you hate to do, but you have no choice. And that's exactly what you should do. Many businesses claim that they don't have enough time to make these phone calls. Big mistake. You either find the time or hire a temp that specializes in telephone collections. Every dollar collected goes right to the bottom line. Collecting is very much like selling. There's never enough time for either one. In selling, the goal is known as qualifying the prospect. You spend more time with what appears to be a good prospect and less time with a prospect that means less to you. You can't afford to spend an equal amount of time with every prospect. So too in collections, where the goal is called resolving the account. You want to communicate so well that you either get a customer to pay more money sooner than they had planned, or you discover that they don't intend to pay, or pay as much, or as soon. And again, the sooner you find out where you stand, the better off you are. One unfortunate fact is that almost every business works their overdue accounts too slowly and hangs on to losers too long. The average business sits on unpaid accounts an average of 9 to 10 months, which is twice as long as it makes any rational, logical, economic sense. Because you know, or you could know, where you stand with your slow and your non-paying accounts in 3 to 4 months. So work your accounts early and often and cut your losses much earlier. But what do you do with accounts you can't collect? You have several options, and I'll explain what they are and the advantages and disadvantages of each one. The least expensive third-party collection tool is called a pre-collection letter service, which is a series of letters that tells your customer, who is a debtor, to send the money directly to you. You can get these letters from companies such as Transworld Systems, IC Systems, National Revenue Corporation, and many others, usually for under $10 an account. But be sure to buy a minimum package of accounts. Some collection agencies will give you a letter or two for free if you assign any account to them where the letters don't produce the money. You can collect about 60% or more of your money if you use the letter service within 3 months of when the money was due. After that, they tend to be a waste of time and money, and you should use a different type of third party to collect. The next option I'll discuss is small claims court. If your debtor has assets and you have a good address, you have an excellent way to collect. The cost is in the neighborhood of $35 to $60 to file the case and serve suit papers on the debtor. The clerk at the county courthouse can tell you about the process. No attorneys are allowed in the courtroom. Each state has a maximum dollar limit that you can sue on in small claims court. Nationwide, over one-third of all debtors that are sued pay up as soon as they get served with the suit papers, because now they know you really mean business. Another one-third never bother to show up in court, and you get a judgment by default. A judgment is not money, but the court clerk can give you information about ways of converting a judgment into money, as well as those situations where the judgment might be worthless. Another collection option is to have an attorney send a letter for you. People may throw away other letters, but letters from attorneys tend to be opened. Forget about using a high-priced attorney. There's a better way. This is the most over-lawyered country in the world, and they keep graduating new ones every year. Most of them do not get big-paying jobs at law firms, which means there are a lot of hungry lawyers out there. You could get a list of newly graduated attorneys from your state bar association and offer one of them a few dollars per letter while they're building their practice. The best-known option for accounts you can collect is a collection agency. The good news with them is that it costs you nothing to use them unless they collect, in which case they keep roughly 25 to 50% of the money recovered. That's a big chunk of your money, so I suggest you explore the other options as well. Collection agencies are pros at skip tracing, which is finding people that don't want to be found, and locating money they have that they don't want you to know about. And if you don't want to make collection phone calls, they have nothing better to do all day long. Now I'd like to talk about some common debtor myths and games and how you can best deal with them. Debtors' creativity in avoiding or slowing down payment is staggering. Unless you're the creditor to whom the money is owed, you can only smile and admire the thought and energy expended in being irresponsible. Much self-righteousness, denial, and justification comes from debtors who aren't honest. Here's a short list of thoughts debtors use to justify giving you, the creditor, aggravation in collection work. 1. I have a lot of other bills to pay. 2. I'd rather spend it on a vacation. 3. They don't need the money so badly. 4. They should feel sorry for me. 5. I couldn't resist buying it. 6. I'll pay it back someday, trust me. 7. When I get paid, you'll be the first one I pay back. 8. I expect a big check soon. 9. There's larceny in everyone's. Have you ever heard so much whining? Before I continue, I want to emphasize that I am not an attorney, and even if I were, I'm not your attorney. Although I make no statements that I haven't checked carefully with my attorneys, you must not rely on any of the comments on this tape as being legal advice for your business. In any case, there are certain universal myths that debtors everywhere seem to know about. 1. As long as I pay you regularly, even a dollar a month, there's nothing you can do. This old war story is literally that, a war story. It goes back to the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act of World War II, which in effect said that if you're making a good faith attempt to pay, even a dollar a month, as long as you are a uniformed member of the armed services, you can't be required to pay more. Not only is World War II long over, and most of your debtors are not in uniform, but the act has been struck off the books. It's just awfully hard to convince some debtors of that. Myth number 2. As long as I make regular payments, more than a dollar a month, you can't turn me into collection. Wrong. A creditor has the right at any time to use any third-party collection service on the unpaid balance and to do it without warning the debtor. In practice, though, a creditor is foolish to do that because if he at least warns the debtors to pay or else go to collection, some of those debtors will pay, and the creditor can thereby avoid collection costs. There's a myth that some angry creditors believe is true. If the debtor doesn't pay, the creditor can attach the debtor's wages, execute on the debtor's bank account, or repossess the debtor's car. At one time, a creditor could make what's known as a pre-judgment attachment, which is what those are, but not anymore. Today, you have to get a judgment from a court to repossess, levy, or execute on assets. The next subject is games. I arbitrarily classify debtor games as gentle or serious games. Let's discuss the gentle games first. The first one is accusations. Common debtor accusations can include the following. 1. You're harassing me. 2. You're dunning me. 3. You're a money grubber. 4. You can't get blood out of a turnip. These accusations are all phony, so simply deny them. Say, I'm not harassing you, or I am not dunning you. I am not a money grubber. You are not a turnip. You're a customer that owes us $250, and you need to tell me how you plan to take care of that. If you want to take a shot at a debtor who's giving you a particularly bad time, accusing you of harassment, try this response. You know, debtor, if you'd paid this bill as agreed, I wouldn't have had to send bills, make phone calls, run up unnecessary expenses, and aggravate myself. Actually, it's you who's harassing me. The next game is one of indignation, where the debtor throws something like this at you. Your prices are unbelievable. What am I doing, paying for the boss's Cadillac? Any time there's any sign of good fortune, such as a new office, a new car, a redecorated customer area, a new truck, or new stationery, you can expect to be tested. Some jealous debtors will throw the affluence in your face in an attempt to avoid paying you. I hear about collectors being subjected to this petty annoyance all the time. I don't consider this game anything but a gentle poke in the ribs, which deserves a poke back. For example, if the debtor sees a new fish tank in your waiting area and says, I guess I'm paying for your new fish tank today, you can respond in the same spirit and say, no, you're just paying for the guppies and the air bubbler, and we really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. This next gentle game is called offensive tackle, when the debtor says this type of thing. Why are your prices so high? This approach is a little trickier. Prices are relative and arbitrary, so a suggestion that yours are too high is an attempt to put you on the defensive and avoid talking about how the bill is going to be paid. You can handle this game by responding with a statement such as, I guess it does seem high. It's amazing how high everything is these days. I remember when gas was 20 cents a gallon, don't you? And the house I live in, well, I'm glad I bought it 20 years ago, because if I had to buy it today, I couldn't afford it. Now we have to discuss how you plan to take care of this. You can substitute other examples of how everything seems to go up in price. So instead of arguing with the debtor, you're agreeing with him, but reminding him that the bill has to be paid anyway. All you're really agreeing with is the sentiment. You'd better actually be proud of your fees and prices, because if you aren't, that feeling will communicate itself to your customers. I promise you that whatever you feel about the reasonableness of your charges will be communicated to the debtor one way or another. How about when a child answers the phone and the parents are never home? This consumer debt problem concerns kids trained by their parents to tell all strange-sounding voices that no one is at home. Of course, this statement coming from a 3-, 4-, or 5-year-old is a little surprising, considering that someone older should be at home. If you suspect you've reached one of these trained kids, particularly if you hear adult voices in the background, use one of these approaches. The child says no one is at home. You say, in a stern voice, don't you lie to me, you go get your mom right now. Some kids will respond to a direct order from any authoritative sounding voice. One business I know of had this experience. They said to the kid, is your daddy home? No. Is your mommy home? No. Then you say, "Would you please go ask your mom what time she's coming home?" One kid who was told that came back to the phone and said, "My mom said to tell you that she's never coming home." Sometimes messages are left on answering machines, but no calls are returned. This passive game elicits an active response from you. You have a serious problem. Send a final, certified letter. If that doesn't get a response, bite the bullet, out to collection it goes. Another game. Suppose you can't get any commitment to pay. The debtor says, "I'll try to pay this next week." Look out. The word "try" is a red flag. Your debtor, who sounds so reasonable, has made no commitment whatever. One either does something or one doesn't. Did you ever try to lift a glass off a table? No, you either lifted it or you didn't. Another game is broken agreements. They are very common. Suppose you and the debtor agree to 5 payments of $50 each. The first $50 payment comes in as promised. The second one is paid on time, but the amount is only $25. You have 3 choices. 1. Hope the additional $25 will be paid next time. 2. Turn the account into collection. 3. Call the debtor immediately. The correct choice is 3. Anytime you and the debtor make an agreement, the day the agreement is not honored in full, call up your debtor and either ask her to keep the agreement, or if the circumstances have changed or the debtor sells you on some new story, you and the debtor can agree to a new payment plan. What you don't do is let the debtor unilaterally, on her own, violate the agreement without an immediate response on your part. There are so many other forms of active and passive resistance to paying that it's too tedious to list them all. I include the debtors who run out of your company yelling, "Bill me," the ones who claim to speak no English, those who pay your bill but not the late charge, who pay that $50 bill in pennies. You can see how debtors have unlimited options. I'll end our gentle game section with a situation that will take some courage on your part. Suppose your debtor owes you $200 and sends you $5, which you hadn't agreed to, or some other ridiculous payment. Send it back. Is that crazy? Absurd? No. Do you say a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush? I say a bird in the hand is a big mess. Did you ever have a bird in your hand? Send back the payment. Your debtor is playing games with you, hoping you'll feel that something is better than nothing. Your debtor is trying to buy you off. If you accept the $5, you've been bought. When you send back the ridiculous payment, a strange and wondrous thing happens. You usually get more money in return, because the debtor knows that their little trick didn't work. When you send back the $5, you enclose a note saying what you will accept. If you don't have the heart to send the $5 back, keep it, but call or send a note saying you're accepting the $5 only as a partial payment on a minimum of, name a figure. In other words, by confronting the small payment game, you're again playing the odds more successfully. Now for some serious games. Included in what I arbitrarily call serious games are phones slammed down, crying, screaming, and physical threats. The games are serious because they extract an emotional toll from the collector, and these accounts go out to collection fairly quickly. First, slam phones. There really isn't much you can do about this. Your debtor is clearly communicating that he doesn't want to deal with the problem. You can try the following two approaches to avoid turning this debtor into collection, but frankly, neither has much chance of success. They're just better than doing nothing. One option is to wait a day or two and try again. Or, call back immediately. When the debtor answers the phone, say that you must have been disconnected and you'll probably get another phone slammed in your ear. Another serious game is cursing. Some debtors will curse you to your face, but most are more likely to do it on the phone. The most professional way to deal with filthy language is this 4-step approach. If your debtor is cussing you out, for step one you say, "I'm not willing to talk with you if you use that kind of language." If they keep cussing at you, you say, "If you keep talking to me like that, I'm going to have to hang up the phone." If they're still cussing, "I'm going to hang up the phone now." And if that doesn't stop them, step four, hang up the phone. The skeptics say, sure, that's exactly what they wanted, for you to hang up and buy some more time. Maybe so, but you've given the debtor three chances to think it over, and you certainly can't force the debtor to clean up his language. Once again, you have no guarantee. You are just astutely playing the odds, and you certainly don't need to sit and listen to that garbage. Another, slightly more gutsy way of dealing with foul-mouthed debtors was taught to me by an 80-year-old, sweet, grandmotherly woman from a small town. Her first job required her to call some debtors on the phone. One of these debtors shouted some choice obscenities at her. She was only 20 at the time, and she was so unnerved that she put down the phone, walked around the block for a half hour, and asked herself whether she really wanted the job if that was what she had to put up with. Well, she talked herself into staying because she needed the money. Over the years, she learned how to handle pretty much of anything. Now when she calls a debtor who uses foul language, she knows exactly what to do. She lets him mouth off for 5 or 10 seconds, and then she cuts in, saying, "I love it when you talk dirty like that." She says that stops him every time. Some debtors say, "You do?" Well, she really doesn't, but she knows how to play the game. Physical threats. If the debtor is in your presence and threatens to get physical, end the conversation right away and get away. Screaming. The louder they get, the softer you get. The Bible states it very well. A soft voice turneth away wrath. Your debtor is overcome with emotion, so reasonable, logical argument is of no use. A little feedback of feelings might help, as in, "I can understand that this is really upsetting you." If the debtor calms down, you might try to resume the logic of why the debt must be paid. Finally, crying. Crying is really unnerving. It may be an attempt at manipulation by an accomplished actor, or it can be genuine anguish and despair about the situation. Either way, you're likely to be touched. You have a debtor who, again, is all feeling and very little logic. It is appropriate to back off now, but let the debtor know that the problem isn't going to disappear. You can say, "I'm so sorry this is causing you such distress. Why don't I call you back at another time so we can discuss this?" This is a temporary respite only, is the message you're giving. Occasionally, I have employees who want to discuss a problem that is upsetting enough to make them cry. I just stop talking and put the Kleenex in front of them, and they get through the crisis quickly. Never say to someone who's upset or crying that they shouldn't feel that way. This statement only makes the situation worse. Just acknowledge the feeling and watch it disappear. Whether the games are gentle or serious, the following truths will help. 1. You can't control the conversation. What you can better control is your own reactions to it and your responses to the debtor. 2. You make the rules, and you can refuse to accept the debtor's proposals. But don't take this to be support for becoming a petty tyrant. Be flexible in payment arrangements. 3. No matter what the debtor does, the underlying reality is that the debt must be taken care of. That is your point of view. How you express it is of secondary importance. There are even more collection problems, stalls, and excuses. The focus here is on the specific classic excuses and the more effective responses. The responses are initial responses because you have no idea what hidden agenda may be going on or where the conversation will go. Stall number 1. "I never got your bill." When the debtor offers you this stall, you should immediately come back with, "What is your current address?" If the address the debtor gives is different from the one that you have on record, you should take down the new address and respond, "I'll have it sent right out to your new address. Do you plan to handle payment by check or credit card?" If the address is the same, respond with, "That's the address we used. I'll send another bill today. Do you plan to take care of it when you receive it?" Your responses are closing off debtor escape routes. Your next comment or action will depend on how cooperative or evasive your debtor is. Number 2, "Your computer must be fouled up. We never bought any of that stuff." You should reply by asking the name of the company. For example, "Is this the Great American Electric Company at 23 Nordhoff Drive? If the person replies that it is, you say, "Well, Jay Berger ordered them October 5th, and we delivered them. If the person replies that you reached the wrong address, just say, sorry, our mistake. What phone number is this, please? Number three, debtor's secretary is an efficient call screener and says, may I tell him what this is about? You should tell the secretary why you're calling. It's about a large unpaid bill owed to us. If the secretary says, I'll transfer you to our accounts payable department, respond with, I've talked with them already and we got nowhere. Please tell your boss that he needs to call me today at 687-9456 or this matter is out of my hands. Stall number four, I have other bills to pay. This is a common excuse. We all have bills to pay. So you reply, this is one of your bills also, and it must be paid in full now. What we need to do is discuss how you plan to do this. Number five, if you have to sue to get paid and your debtor says, sue me, get in line, buddy, or why don't you take a long walk on a short pier? Just say, thank you, goodbye. There's not much to discuss here. Go ahead and sue. Number six, how can you ask an old lady like me to pay? Believe me, your customer's heart won't break if you tell her, I am truly sorry if this is causing you distress, and I wish I didn't have to call you, but you do owe $185, and you do need to take care of it now. Stall number seven. The check is in the mail. To counter this lame cliche, say, great. What's the check number? When was it sent? In what amount? To whom? How was it sent? In other words, get specifics. Number eight, I can send you $5 a month. On a large bill, you have to say, well, on your $500 bill, we just can't accept that. If the debtor then says, I swear that's all I can pay, you respond with, if you'll come into our office and fill out a statement of income and expenses, I may be able to grant you an extension on this, but that's the only way I can do it. If the debtor does come in and provide the information, you have a sign of debtor responsibility and you can cooperate. If your debtor refuses, you're better off letting a third party, such as a collection agency, try to reason with the debtor. Stall number nine. My husband handles all the bills. Handle this ploy by saying that you'll contact the husband at work if necessary. Say, I'm sure he doesn't want to be bothered at work. Please have him call me tomorrow so we can get this cleared up. Tell him it's an urgent matter that must be dealt with now. Thank you. Notice I don't volunteer to call the spouse. I ask them to call me. Only if they don't call, then I'll call them. Number 10. We can pay you when our customers pay us. This is a very common stall. You may be tempted to ask how they can afford to pay the staff, but instead you say, I wish we could do business with you like that, but I have a better idea. I'm going to recommend some places you can borrow from so you can pay this, and you can choose which one is best for you. Number 11, I'm not working now. An understanding response is, I'm really sorry to hear that. When did that happen? What are your prospects? Where is your wife working? Let's discuss some other sources of money to take care of this bill and perhaps some of your other ones. Number 12, we went with another company. Why should we have to pay for your project design? If you respond with, do you remember my telling you that you'd have to pay for the design work regardless of who got the construction work? You're on weak bargaining grounds as we discussed earlier. Any agreement should have been in writing. Your oral agreement may stand up in court if this case goes there, but I wouldn't count on it. Number 19, I'm bankrupt. So you ask, when did that happen? Please send me a copy of the bankruptcy notice. If your debt was incurred prior to the bankruptcy, you may be out of luck in collecting and you may not pursue the debtor further. Go on to another account. Stall number 20. I'll send you something on this soon. You already know how to handle this stall based on our previous discussion. So you say, I appreciate that, and what I need to know is exactly what you plan to send and when. Now you're off and running in the negotiation. Number 21, I'm not paying, period. You've got to love a debtor like this because he's so straightforward. He tells you right up front that you've got a big problem, which saves you from wasting time fishing for the bad news. Try this. Thank you for being so honest with me. Would you tell me why you say that? The debtor's response tells you whether you have someone you can reason and negotiate with, or an impossible debtor who helps you make an easy decision to bring in a third-party professional collector. Number 22, I just can't pay it all now. Your debtor is asking you to negotiate, so go ahead. Say, we can accept half now and a post-dated check for the balance sent with it. May the best negotiator win. Number 23, I'm not the person who owes this. That's my dad, John B. Martin. Do not say, oops, sorry, where can I reach him? This really could be John B. Martin, who's playing a game, pretending to be someone else. Whatever happens next will tell the story. John B. emerges and pays. John B. calls back and won't pay. There is no John B. Or the debtor is actually John B., but won't admit it. The game playing can become tiresome, but you can become quicker at sensing the deception. This is by no means the full list of debtors' stalls and evasions. The point is to resolve these problems as quickly as possible. Every business is concerned about harassment, and rightly so. If you're not sure of what you can say or do to collect, you will, understandably, be less aggressive in collecting. Suppose, as you're attempting to collect on the phone, the debtor shouts in obvious anger, "You can't harass me. I know my rights. I'm going to call my attorney." Whoops. Now what do? Have you accidentally done or said something that might possibly be interpreted as harassment? If you aren't sure, the prudent thing to do is to back off. After all, some customers are lawsuit happy. But there's no point backing off just because you aren't sure what harassment is. Number 19, I'm bankrupt. So you ask, when did that happen? Please send me a copy of the bankruptcy notice. If your debt was incurred prior to the bankruptcy, you may be out of luck in collecting and you may not pursue the debtor further. Go on to another account. Stall number 20, I'll send you something on this soon. You already know how to handle this stall based on our previous discussion. So you say, I appreciate that, and what I need to know is exactly what you plan to send and when. Now you're off and running in the negotiation. Number 21, I'm not paying, period. You've got to love a debtor like this because he's so straightforward. He tells you right up front that you've got a big problem, which saves you from wasting time fishing for the bad news. Try this. Thank you for being so honest with me. Would you tell me why you say that? The debtor's response tells you whether you have someone you can reason and negotiate with, or an impossible debtor who helps you make an easy decision to bring in a third-party professional collector. Number 22, I just can't pay it all now. Your debtor is asking you to negotiate, so go ahead. Say, we can accept half now and a post-dated check for the balance sent with it. May the best negotiator win. Number 23, I'm not the person who owes this. That's my dad, John B. Martin. Do not say, oops, sorry, where can I reach him? This really could be John B. Martin, who's playing a game, pretending to be someone else. Whatever happens next will tell the story. John B. emerges and pays. John B. calls back and won't pay. There is no John B., or the debtor is actually John B., but won't admit it. The game playing can become tiresome, but you can become quicker at sensing the deception. This is by no means the full list of debtors' stalls and evasions. The point is to resolve these problems as quickly as possible. Every business is concerned about harassment, and rightly so. If you're not sure of what you can say or do to collect, you will, understandably, be less aggressive in collecting. Suppose, as you're attempting to collect on the phone, the debtor shouts in obvious anger, "You can't harass me. I know my rights. I'm going to call my attorney." Whoops. Now what do? Have you accidentally done or said something that might possibly be interpreted as harassment? If you aren't sure, the prudent thing to do is to back off. After all, some customers are lawsuit happy. But there's no point backing off just because you aren't sure what harassment is. In this section, I will spell out the basic rules of the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, or the FDCPA, as enacted by the U.S. Congress and interpreted by the Federal Trade Commission. The FDCPA applies only to collection agencies and attorneys doing collection work for others. It does not apply to your business. But there are some darn good reasons for focusing on the federal law on this tape. First, the states all have harassment legislation that in many cases is similar to the federal law. Second, if you follow the FDCPA, which is about as tough as it gets, you'll know with enough certainty that you're not violating any laws. So, even if a debtor accuses you of harassment, you can be content in knowing that you aren't guilty. You may not be able to convince the debtor, but that's another matter. Right now, I want to suggest that you don't back off prematurely or, for that matter, actually commit an act of harassment out of ignorance. Let's get specific. When can you call a debtor at home? You can call at any time convenient for the debtor, which is normally from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. in the debtor's time zone. Suppose your debtor works the swing shift, also called the second shift, or the lobster shift, as they call it in New England, which may be the third shift. If you call your debtor at 2 p.m., which is a fine time for most people, she might be sleeping. The first time you call at 2 p.m. and she's sleeping isn't harassment if you didn't know that that was a bad time to call. But the next time you call at or around 2 p.m. and she's sleeping is harassment because you did know or should have known that your debtor usually sleeps at that time. How should you have known? By writing it down the first time you called. Always record all your communications. As for concern about time zones, most of your customers will be in your own time zone, or you may live close to the intersection of two of them. Just be sure to add or subtract enough hours to compensate for the difference, if any. Can you call a debtor on the job? Some collectors are confused about this point, so let's take it a step at a time. First, if you're dealing with a commercial debt, which is money owed by a business to another business, you can talk to anyone at the business about the bill. With a consumer debt, the rules are much more stringent. You may call a consumer debtor on the job, and you don't have to call at home first either, although I recommend that you do. Calling on the job is inherently more stressful to a debtor, and you don't need to go out of your way to help create resistance and stress when you'd be better off if you tried at home first. But suppose you do call the debtor on the job, only she doesn't answer. A coworker or a supervisor does. You can't tell them what you're calling about, and you can't say that it's some kind of an emergency as an inducement to get them to bring your debtor to the phone, unless it is an emergency. What you can say is that it's personal or personal business, and then leave your name and phone number. You can also leave the name of the company you're calling from. There are some women collectors calling either at the job or at home who use a sexy voice when they call, leave their first name and phone number if they don't get the debtor himself. This ploy gets a response usually, but it's a no-no on the grounds that it misrepresents the nature of the call. Suppose you call a debtor on the job and the debtor does answer or is brought to the phone but says, "Don't you ever call me here again." You can't call again, and he doesn't have to put that in writing either. You put it in writing on your collection call notes. But this demand by the debtor doesn't end the call. You respond with this, "Fine, Mr. Debtor, I won't call you here on the job as your request, but I can't reach you at your home phone either. All I get is a recording, and you never return the call. You've also ignored the mail we've sent on this. So, what we have to do is discuss on this phone call how you plan to take care of the bill in a way that's going to work for both of us, or I really don't have any choice but to place the account with our collection agency, which I prefer not to do. We really like to work things out directly with our customers ourselves, one-on-one, but if you're unwilling to do that, I don't have any choice. So won't you please tell me how you plan to pay this so I don't have to turn the account into collection?" With that kind of an approach, you've given a clear choice. You've sugarcoated your promise to use a collection agency by saying we hate to do it. And you've been forthcoming about all you've done up to this point to communicate with the debtor. If this fails, you can be pretty satisfied about turning the account into collection, knowing that you're making a business decision and not merely trying to get even. How often can you call? The answer is not too often. To be more specific, whether or not harassment exists on call frequency is ultimately determined by a jury of people such as you and me. Suppose we're on a jury and we learn that a collector has called a debtor once a month. Is that considered too often? Most people don't think so. Is calling once a week too often? Again, most people wouldn't agree. On the other hand, a collector calling every hour on the hour isn't generally considered reasonable. The tactic sounds more like the act of a vindictive person trying to get some satisfaction for being ignored. The difficulty of defining how often is too often brings to mind a well-known story attributed to Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, who was asked to give a definition of pornography. He said, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." Next, who can you communicate with about the bill? With a commercial bill, you can communicate with anyone in the debtor company. With a consumer bill, you can talk or write to the debtor, the attorney who's handling that matter, and in many states, the spouse. The implications of this ruling include, number one, you can't send a postcard about the debt through the mail because the post office personnel could read about it. Two, you can't have the words past due on the envelope. You can't put anything on an envelope that indicates the contents are about money owed. Three, you have to be careful with answering machines. Always assume that an attorney is listening in and will be delighted to sue you for allowing him to hear what you're calling about. You never know who will be standing by when the message is played. You should say something like this. "This is Marty Anderson calling from Anderson Air Conditioning Company about an important matter. Will you please call me right back between 8 and 4:30? Thank you." It's also okay to use words like urgent or important in your message on the answering machine. So, these are the main rules of harassment. I doubt if any of you have been harassing any of your customers, but I don't want you to back off just because a customer accuses you of harassment. And, obviously, you cannot swear at your customer, you can't make physical threats, put them on a deadbeat list, or say that you're going to do something to collect that you don't intend to do or cannot legally do. In conclusion, even though some customers who owe you money get nasty, good collectors never do. Don't ever think you have to be tough or hard-nosed. Just be clear about the rules of the game up front. Stick to your guns on payment, cut your losses early, and you'll build your business faster, more profitably, and with less stress. Good luck.
We hope this edition of the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month has given you many new ideas to help you run your company more effectively. Along with this month's tape, you also receive several other things. There is a short summary of the tape you just heard, a brief outline of the program for quick review, and you will also find a customer response card enclosed. There is a place on the card for your comments on this tape, as well as space for suggestions you would like to make for topics on future tapes. The response card is postage paid, so please write down a few comments and drop it in the mail. We would love to hear from you. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.